Without an historical understanding of how we have got to where we are today, it's very difficult to have a good argument against some of the dominant trends.
I'm Christiana Facey Crowther, and I'll be your nurse today. Thanks for joining me at the bedside. All good care starts with a good history, and a history of nursing starts with Siobhan Nelson, historian, scholar, thought leader, registered nurse. We sit down together in her home office on a warm spring day. If you listen closely, you can hear the birds tweeting in the big tree outside her open window. You can also hear when a construction crew arrives to demo the neighbor's front walkway. But hey, we're nurses. You come to expect that there will be some form of complication, always. So we assessed, we adjusted, got a consult, a bit of post-production audio engineering, and voila! I hope you enjoy Siobhan Nelson as much as I do.
Welcome to At the Bedside, Siobhan.
Thank you.
Thank you for speaking with me. Can we start with you just describing your career?
I started my nursing program after I went to university and in Australia and studied history. And when I lived in the Northern Territory, which is in the remote northwest of Australia, was when I started my nursing program. So it was an incredibly interesting program. At least half, if not more, of the patient population were Indigenous, many from very remote populations, didn't speak any English, that type of practice. I enjoyed living in the Territory and working with all sorts of different patients and different colleagues. And one of the things that was interesting about working in the Territory is that you form a very strong team with all of the other professionals, because everybody's in the north and a lot of people coming through on rotation and so on, and really rely on those of us who are there all the time, the nursing staff who are there all the time to help orient the trainee physicians and orient the visiting consultants and so on. So you ended up, I think, with a really good sense of what everybody's job was, what needed to come together to be successful for patients, and a lot of priority, of course, on the social and cultural issues that affect health, particularly for an Indigenous population, but also for people living in remote areas where they don't have access to much care. So that was my introduction to nursing. And eventually, I worked in all different kinds of areas. I did a lot of surgical, and I did home nursing, I did emergency nursing, and working in all sorts of different environments. And when I started graduate school, what happened was, because of my fundamental training in history and politics, most academic questions presented themselves to me as historical questions. So I ended up moving to do my PhD in humanities, which was a fantastic experience, after which I moved into academic work and then went to University of Melbourne, where I had the fortune of being one of the first people hired for a brand new nursing school. There had not been any nursing program at the University of Melbourne. It was a very elitist and prestigious institution, not the sort of place that nursing had been very welcome in Australia. And so a new school was being set up, and I was a postdoc there. I won a postdoctoral fellowship for 3 years there. And so I had the fortune of being there when we were starting a graduate program, when we were developing curriculum, when we were setting in policies and so on. So in 5 years, I learned every aspect of how you run a nursing program, accreditation, different clinical teaching, graduate teaching, supervision and ethics, all of those kinds of things, which I think people don't normally have the opportunity to do. So I was quickly in a senior role and eventually was head of that school after a few years, and then was recruited to Toronto, where I was dean at the University of Toronto. So my academic career was quite a fast track compared to many others, but I think that was circumstances in many respects. And the work that I have always done in terms of my scholarship reflects my historical and political science training, and I'm interested in broadly two things. One is where the profession sits with respect to the state and the healthcare system. So issues such as regulation, the boundaries between different professions, the way healthcare is organised, the role of nursing and the different nursing roles and how they butt up against various structures, all of those kinds of things come under the sociology of the professions, and many of my graduate students have done projects that look at policy one way or another, and historical work. And in terms of history, I've looked at many different periods, but I have always been interested in the way care of the sick is organised, the place of the practice in terms of its social organisation, the values that are attached to it, the gender issues that constitute it, more in some places than in others, more at some times than others, and what all of that can tell us about why care of the sick is important at one time, and what place nursing has within the social, political, economical structures of a particular society. And I think thinking about those things helps us understand the place of nursing today and the place of care of sick today.
I think when you say the position of nursing in society, I think that's something that a lot of nurses who are even practicing think about in our own work, how it's reflected in society, how the people that we know think about the work that we do, what they understand about it. Why do you think it's important for nursing and nurses to have a sense of its own history in terms of how we practice now?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of reasons why it's important. The problem of being ahistorical, that is, going through the world without any sense of history, is that you are victim to what the latest ideas or the latest interpretation of you and your practice or your profession are reflected in the media or by other professions or so on. And I think without an historical understanding of how we have got to where we are today, it's very difficult to have a good argument against some of the dominant trends. I think if you think all policy is basically historical, the laws that we have are basically historical, they were produced at a particular time and in a particular place for certain reasons. When we lose a sense of what they are, it's very difficult to actually have informed debates or informed discussions. So to give an example of what I'm trying to say here, in terms of nursing practice compared to medical practice. So medicine is a profession with a strong historical sense. I don't mean that every physician knows the history of science and knows the history of their profession, but they do, I think, have a strong sense that they, as clinicians and as professionals, are standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, that whole scientific thing. They understand that there's a scientific tradition that they're based on, that there were important breakthroughs that evolved their practice, that the fact that they can do X, Y, and Z in terms of their diagnosis or understanding of the body is not something they've produced or is 2 years old or something. There may be some revolutions, but basically it's an evolutionary process. Nursing not only doesn't have that evolutionary sense of its practices, in fact, it in many respects scorns what went before. It has a sense that the nurses before were not as scientific, they were not as clinical, they were not doing whatever whiz-bang things we're doing today, they were not prescribing, or they were not whatever it is that we think is the important accomplishment that we have in terms of our professional standing. And we don't get a sense of the importance of the work that was done by those who came before us, the way how the care of the sick, the care of patients before antibiotics, before various other innovations in the 20th century, how much their survival relied on skilled nursing, on expert nursing, how important nursing was then as now to ensuring that people survived surgery, to ensuring they could manage their illnesses, to making sure families were able to plan their children and their contraception, all sorts of incredibly important things. We don't respect that work. We don't see it as intelligent, educated and skilled work because we're a bit dazzled by the technology and whatever advanced practice sort of things we're allowed to do now. And I feel that that's a great problem for nursing's pride in our practice and our understanding that the knowledge and skill that comes from close attention to bodies, practice with sick bodies, offers you, that it's not visible necessarily in scientific papers, but there were many reasons why nurses weren't able to do that or excluded from that. They were women, it was managed through medicine, and science had a very narrow focus. So there's lots of reasons why we don't necessarily see that. But I think if we look, we can find the incredible work that nurses have done in the past, and we should have a better understanding of that in order to, I think, respect our profession, respect the work, and the skill that comes with it.
I'd like to explore a little bit more something that's going on in my own work around a return to the fundamentals of care as an idea that's guiding my organization, but I want to touch a bit on where you talk about women and nursing as a profession for women and of women. Can you talk a bit about how that evolved?
It's a very 19th century history, I have to say, because in the period before the 19th century, you don't necessarily find nursing as closely gendered as became the case in the 19th century, a bit, but so what happened in the 19th century is you had a confluence of the scientific revolution, the medical revolution, a transformation in hospital care from being to being much more experimental, looking at procedures that were going to save lives rather than holding houses for the poor, the sick poor. With all medicine and surgery and so on happening in people's homes, if they had the money to do so. So you had a lot of things changing in the 18th and 19th century. I'm overgeneralizing here, but just to have a sense that there were many things afoot that changed the way medicine was practiced. You had the rise of the medical profession. You had the transformation of the hospitals. And amidst all of that, you had an incredible burgeoning of urban poor. You had growth in the cities, people pouring out of the countryside. It happened over the past 100, 200 years. You had mass migration to the US and Canada and all sorts of places. So it was an enormous period for hospital building. It was an enormous period for medical foundation, the established medical profession. And what needed to happen was that you needed to have women, you needed to have nurses who were literate, nurses who would follow doctors' orders. So there were all of those kinds of new requirements as a more medical model was starting to evolve. At the same time, you had a shift in society with women starting to claim a social space. This is largely beginning with the temperance movement, so through the middle of the 19th century, I'm talking about the US and Canada and a little bit around Britain, and these things happened at slightly different periods in other Western countries. But women started to colonize a voice, a social space that was largely based on virtue. And you can see that in the temperance movement, where it was a movement for social reform, which was really around preventing drunkenness, protecting women and children from violence. It sounds like a very fuddy-duddy movement, but actually it was a movement that was really trying to help families and women and babies from being beaten and murdered by their drunken husbands, and to help the working class families survive. So the fight against temperance had a very, it was moral, but it was also a socially progressive in some ways movement. And out of the temperance movement came the suffrage movement. And there was a lot of thinking at the time about women's education. Should there be universities for women? Should women, what kind of schooling was right for women? And in all of this climate, you had the emergence of this idea of the separate spheres. So that if there was a domain that was controlled by women, women's natural abilities, their natural virtue would create an order and a proper growing and appreciation of the elements and of religion and of everything else. So moving out of the domestic domain, which was the woman's authority, into things that were like the domestic domain, like the sick room. So there was a natural, it was a little bit harder for education. They had to make a slightly more constrained argument. But for nursing, it seemed like this natural thing. And Florence Nightingale was prime example of a woman who was struggling to find a place for her voice, highly intelligent, very well educated, but no purchase socially. There was nothing for a woman like that to do. And the idea of a mission, anyone who's read George Eliot and Middlemarch, it's the same story. The 19th century was this time of struggle of where, what is a woman's proper place? A pious woman, an intelligent woman, an educated woman. And nursing became the site of that. And the idea was very much that if we could elevate the type of woman who came into nursing, we would have so it wasn't a degraded profession, it wasn't a semi-servant profession. The sick would be properly looked after, the poor would be morally reformed as well as physically reformed. At that time, there was an elision, one could say, between the moral world and the physical world. So there was an idea that, very strong idea for many, many years, that venereal disease was the result of depravity. So prostitutes got venereal disease because they were prostitutes. It was a cyclical argument. So, you know, that was the thinking. So if you start from that premise, you can see that having noble women come into nursing to help ship shape up those working class nurses and make sure that they minded their P's and Q's and stopped drinking and separated themselves from patients, then the hospital could be reformed to a place of order and cleanliness. So the first decades of nursing education, proper training and so on, the nursing schools that started to emerge towards the last 25 years of the 19th century, there was a massive focus on cleanliness and hygiene. And then in the early 20th century, as asepsis and these various techniques started to come in, it became even more so. So nurses were like the anti-germ brigade, and middle-class women from a good, clean, middle-class home were seen as the proper people to have this responsibility and to control that domain. And medicine was largely, although there were women fighting to get into medicine at the same time, there were only small numbers for many, many years. Medicine was seen as the masculine scientific and nursing as the, we would today say care, but I actually think it was more about ordering in a sort of housekeeping sense, that everybody ate what they were meant to eat, drank what they were meant to drink, rested when they were meant to rest, everything was clean. And that was the embodiment of care. And of course, when people were dying and in pain, there would be compassion. But it was more that order brings its own kind of harmony. It was very much the philosophy of the time. And that's an intensely gendered discourse that is alive and well in nursing still today, and very evident in non-European countries, where people are saying exactly the same things and about women's suitability for nursing as they were or have been for 150 years in North America, say. So that's why we need to understand history, because if we don't understand that, we don't understand why it is so feminized in our psyche and in the psyche of our society.
And if it is feminized, and that's how women came through nursing, or women sort of entered out into the professions, it's odd to me that we now tend to turn away from emphasis on those roles that the women and nurses occupied as a route towards professionalization, and tend instead to gravitate towards identifying with these more exciting technological, more medical interventions.
Yes, it's probably worth psychoanalyzing, really, which is above, beyond me and you, but I do think that there is a status issue here, that what is privileged in our society are more masculine roles. Men earn more money. Men have jobs that involve machinery and all of those kind of cliches or stereotypes. And it's impossible not to internalize those values. If you can do something that's highly trained and has a lot of autonomy attached to it, we value those. So prescribing, for instance, is an important one because it gives the clinician has a lot of autonomy or authority around prescription. It's though actually in fact we know that that's not the case, but notionally one would think that unless one's actually looked at how it works. And doing sort of teamwork or work that happens at the bedside or away from the bedside, like all that phone calling and organizing things so that the person, when they're being discharged, doesn't sort of fall off a cliff, that's not work anyone sees. And that's a bit like mum work, you know, that's kind of the invisible work that keeps the world together, that people only notice when someone hasn't done it. And so there is a status hierarchy, I think, and we play into it a lot. Also the drama and the excitement around saving lives. Well, if you're in critical care or you're in the emergency room, the saving lives things is like an immediate, absolute, minute-to-minute thing, whereas if you're on a unit or you're working in the community, disease prevention and ensuring that somebody's got maximum mobility and quality of life are hard to measure with the code, running a code. So I think we get sucked into that.
I think it's also something you said where it's hard to measure. Mm. Sometimes it strikes me that with our focus in modern healthcare on measurable, manageable outcomes and ways to measure the impact of patient care, sometimes it seems to me that it's harder to manage and to measure the impact of fundamental nursing care.
I think you're absolutely right. And the problem is, too, that everything that we try and use as proxies just, it doesn't cut it. And I think we're stuck. So one of the ways that people often respond to that issue is they get very ephemeral and a bit essentialist about, you know, caring, and it's not reducible to a number of elements on a checklist. And while I also agree it's not reducible to a number of elements on a checklist, I think that when we get emotional and or we think it's all a big critique of science and evidence-based practice, we're going down the wrong road. I don't think we persuade anyone who needs persuading, and it just makes us feel good because we tell each other that we're misunderstood and we're oppressed. And nursing, in my experience, we all fall into that pretty easily about how badly done by we are. And yet, of course, you talk to anyone of your colleagues in the health professions and you say nursing runs everything. There's absolutely nothing gets done unless nurses agree and so on. So nurses have, a slightly distorted view of their power, and I think that they get great mileage out of the underdog discourse. So I think there's two contradictory things. Like, how do we actually talk about what nursing does without getting either soppy or on our high horse about how dare you try and make me reduce this profound thing that happens between me and the patient, or misunderstood. And I think we can talk about it if we're focusing on the right things. And I think the problem is who sets the criteria and we end up with measures that are very specific and time limited, when often what nursing, good nursing does is effective over time and on repetition with a number of different people. So you're on one, you know, the patient sees one nurse and then they see another nurse and then they see another nurse. And over the course of those interactions, hopefully, they've got a better understanding of their medications. The fact that there were several analgesics that they were prescribed and they thought they were meant to take them all at once only comes out in the third discussion with the third nurse, but it's because they've had that discussion with the first and the second nurse that they're actually able to articulate the right question. So I think how teams work, how the collective works on the patient is actually something that we haven't put enough time and effort into thinking about.
To me, it seems as though when we're talking about quality care, there sometimes seems to be a bit of a tension between the clinical judgment of the individual versus developing protocols, standardizations, and systems. And to me, I see a little bit of a tension around what can you measure more easily, and what should be funded, and what is most valuable, the most valuable way to provide quality care for patients. Do you see attention there?
I do. Yes, for sure. But I also think that we don't count processes enough in nursing, and by which I mean in terms of patient outcomes. And there's been critiques of this, so it's not like other systems are perfect. But you know how in surgery they talk about doing the huddle, doing the final check and talk through. In airline industry with the crew resource management, there's steps that they all have to go through where they all come together at the, before a flight and everybody knows everybody's name and they do this and they do that, and there is a checklist that they have to do on that, because the research shows that the more there's a point of connection between the team, the better they function in a crisis. I mean, I think that looking at a correlation between how does this unit practice versus how does this unit practice, do they all come together? What kind of quality of handover is there? If there have been these many problems in this unit over the past month, is there ever an opportunity for the nurses to get together and to talk about that the way there is among other health professionals or surgeons or so on? Where is the accountability? Where do we actually see the outcomes of our practice come back to us to talk about how we can improve?
Because otherwise, I think when those don't happen, we just sort of accept a certain level of risk,
yeah,
as being inherent to the work that we do and unavoidable. I think you see that sometimes,
yes,
in an environment before something, somebody comes in or some data comes or a seminal event happens or some sort of process comes in where we say, oh, this is actually something we should change.
The reason I focus on that before going to what's measurable is because I think the argument for what constitutes good team functioning, good flow of work, good communication, because we know from all of the literature that those are the things that make the most important, are the most important things in patient safety and in patient outcomes. So the actual elements that get measured cannot actually help drive those ends. And then to those things that get measured, we know that those things tend to drive perverse practices. So if everybody has to do A before B, or there's no funding that comes through, then everybody's going to do A, whether it makes sense or not to do A in this particular case or not. And so you end up then with people thinking, oh, this is meaningless, it's disenchanted. And I mean, I come through a period of nursing when patient care plans were only just being introduced, and they were the most massive things you could possibly imagine. We had to write on paper these pages and pages of patient care plans, and then go back and check the things that had been done, and then they were audited and all this sort of thing. And it was It was so busy. There was no way anyone had time to do this. So they were either minimal or they were just kind of pro forma. Like you wrote the same thing for everyone with diabetes, or you wrote the same thing for everybody who had a closed head injury. You just, because you didn't have time to do that. And I once had to write one on a patient who had died. And the reason I hadn't done one before he came in is he had a ruptured liver, and we spent 5 hours trying to stabilize him, and he didn't make it. And then after he died, I had to sit down and write like a 10-page patient care plan. Or the hospital wasn't going to get its accreditation, and the unit wasn't going to get its auditing, or there was like, this was Kafka-esque, you know? So then you wonder why people are cynical and why people think, all right, what rubbish do we have to do this time? And so I always have this poor man in my mind when I think about these, like, how does this help us? And is it really going to be measuring the quality of what we're doing? And part of that was people were saying, we have to have nursing care written into what the hospital does. Otherwise, people think nurses do nothing. You think, well, no one's going to be reading my patient care plan. There's 10 pages of it, except the nursing auditors. Right. But it's a vexed area. And the more we talk about it and the more people can air their cynicism, and people doing it should listen to that, the better. And I also think the more we focus on what processes do we know from the literature that aid communication, improve team functioning, bring errors to light in a way that everyone can share. They're clumsy, bigger things, but they're actually meaningful in terms of improving the care or the service that people provide.
I really agree with that. If I think about what I would like to see in terms of changes in the care environment, and if I was going to liberate time and energy, I feel like we would be interested in doing that too. I think being interested in something is a huge benefit.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about your newest project, this nursing manual that you are studying.
As part of this broader history project and material culture, I have come across, through colleagues in Spain, a textbook, a manual, called Instrucciones de Enfermeros, which was written initially in, I think it's 1607. The second edition is 1625. It's the second edition that I've been able to view. It's in the National Library in Spain and in the British Library and in the Library of Congress, in the National Library in Mexico and in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. And it was a very important manual, we believe, because it's in so many places, for a new order of nurses that was founded in the early 1600s, maybe 1597, something like that, the Bernardo de Obregón. And it was a counter-reformation, like a new reformist order, like the Sisters of Charity, actually like the Daughters of Charity in France, that took over existing hospitals. It didn't found hospitals. It took over hospitals that needed fixing up, and things are reorganized and are supported. And it's a really wonderful book. I'm working with a translator at the moment. And it's got a number of different sections. It has remedies and cures. But it also, interestingly, has illnesses and nursing care for particular body systems. So for the heart, disease of the heart, disease of the liver, disease of the kidneys, that kind of thing. And it's got a lovely section at the end for care prayers for those who care for the sick, and a kind of self-care sort of section, to use a modern kind of term. In the introduction, it says the goal is to aid in clarifying the work that nurses do, which is useful for nurses but also for physicians and surgeons to understand the work of nurses. And it's quite a remarkable text.
It sounds like, from what you're describing, that there's also a mixture. There's still, even at that time, which we may not think about when you're from the perspective of what nursing is now, that a lot of that is highly medical knowledge, and that that was definitely part of the scope of nursing then, as it is now, even though sometimes it's not always recognized as such. But I know you and Suzanne have written a lot about nursing needing to own and talk a bit more about the depth of knowledge that we do have, especially not just in the interpersonal realm, but also the amount of medical knowledge that we have, and the need for us to start as a profession and as individuals in the profession to practice talking about what we know and what we do.
Yes, it is medical, surprisingly medical in a way, because I'm comparing it with some of the things I've read by the Daughters of Charity, and they're much less science in it. And the term medical science is something that I think causes an unnecessary problem for us. And it's to do with, you know, is it medicine, is it nursing, and the whole discipline building in the 20th century, and this idea that nursing had to be a separate sphere, if you like, in the 19th century, with its own philosophy and its own methodologies and its own discipline. I mean, there's a story that nursing theory came about because they had to write a theoretical base for funding from the National Institutes of Health. I don't know if that's apocryphal or not, but that was certainly that story, and I would believe it, back in the 60s. Medical knowledge, medicine isn't a science. Medicine is an amalgam of sciences. Medicine is biology, epidemiology, chemistry, biochemistry. It's not as though medicine is a science. It's a scientific training addressed to medical issues and to the body and disease. So I don't see how nursing can feel that that's not appropriate for nursing, because we're dealing with bodies and disease and health and health
very
promotion.
Much so.
And how do we do that without understanding chemistry and biology and pharmacology and psychology and many disciplines? Because nursing is a profession and medicine is a profession. They're not disciplines in my mind. They're not academic disciplines. They're made up of a range of academic disciplines that help support the profession and the professional knowledge.
With a huge amount of overlap between them.
Enormous, of course. So social sciences and medicine, biosciences, for medicine and for nursing, there's an enormous amount of overlap because we're dealing with the same situations. The practices are in some ways overlapping, but in many ways not. But they're not separate realms.
Or in some ways the practices have historically existed in one sphere and now have transferred to another. I think one of the reports you wrote, I think, for a national group, Optimizing Scopes of Practice, do you see moving forward? What was the importance of that, and why did you guys write that?
So that was an assessment for the Academy of Health Sciences, and the Academy does assessments like the Academy of Medicine in the US with its To Err Is Human. They're all like reports on the state of science in an area, and the Academy here does the same things. It gets requests from government and from researchers, or from prominent, mainly government. It's meant to help guide policymakers. So there was a lot of discussion about scopes of practice. There were various governments were interested in having an assessment on scopes of practice. It was a difficult assessment to do with my colleagues because there isn't the same robust set of scientific evidence around, say, like there is on oral health, and an assessment on the state of oral health in Canada and recommendations. There's lots of, you know, much more straightforward in some ways assessments that we have done. But this is more political because it deals with legislature, with regulatory structures, with payment structures, the great thing that we're never allowed to talk about, which is how doctors get paid versus how everybody else gets paid. But it's fundamental in driving the organisation of healthcare in every province. And you can't really look at deconstructing the silos that exist and not talk about the way care is funded. But there were some excellent innovations, or there have been some excellent innovations, some in Canada, but many in the US. There's a number of well-known ones in Alaska and a few other places where they developed a paid employee-based model for everyone and worked on various innovations to focus on chronic disease and measure outcomes and had very, very good results. So, I mean, I think there are ways that it can work, and we tried to bring all of those together, but also we thought very ambitiously about what are the multiple domains that need to be addressed when you're thinking about scopes of practice and team-based care. What we argued in that assessment is that if we are serious about team-based care, if we believe the literature on team-based care and interprofessional care and multidisciplinary care, then we have to look at providing organisational structures that reward teams, that outcomes come as teams. There's no point moving to that structure, yet the physician measures their outcomes, the nurse measures their outcomes, the social worker and their outcome. We've got to look at the outcomes from a team base, and there should be funding that relates to those outcomes. I mean, there are some areas where it seems like an obvious solution, and there are examples of where creative people who are not fearful of being rebellious have done workarounds and possibly almost illegal ways of actually organising teams to serve particular populations in very productive ways. But what there's never been is a way to scale that. It's been because 10 brilliant people have got together and have figured this is what this population really does need, and we're just going to make it happen. And that's wonderful, but at a system level, it means nothing changes. And so our real goal was to try and figure out how do we get those innovations and make them scalable, and what would be required. And it doesn't mean that in every inpatient unit you'd have to have this contrived team, because some places it makes sense, some places it doesn't. But certainly with complex populations, it's absolutely essential.
I think that's the trick there, is getting the protected time away from the actual work of patient care to think about how maybe some innovation could happen in your work environment, and how some flexibility in role. I see a lot of potential, even where I, you know, anywhere, some flexibility in role to actually allow the patient to have care delivered to them and to get the decision making closer to the patient.
Yeah.
So that they can actually be present in it. Because if we talk about patient-centered care, which we talk about constantly, to me that is not synonymous with the decision making that happens 3 people removed from the bedside of the patient.
Yeah.
For the majority of the time. And to me that seems like the only way really to bring the patient into the discussion is to have some flexibility in terms of role and scope and how we do that in a local context.
I would agree. You know, Suzanne Gordon's new book, Wounds of War, which is on the VA, it's part of a big campaign to stop the privatisation of the VA.
I've heard her speak about that multiple times.
But there is a chapter in that book that is around traumatic brain injury, PTSD and substance abuse, and clients with all three of those, and some really innovative programs to manage these individuals who just can't even be in an inpatient unit. It's so difficult for them. There has been some thinking recently about who are the big users of the system and why are they taking so many resources, all that sort of thing. You know, the province did some good thinking about that a couple of years ago. Most of the funding went to primary care, and I don't see that there was much opportunity for innovations that involve nurses in maybe a few, but largely in the primary care context. But I think there's lots of inpatient populations that you could think about who is really taking all the resources, what are the ways that we can be innovative, and that's where you think this has to be a team. It's not a question of just throwing an extra nurse or two at it. Like, what would be the right team to work around it? And what we tried to do in that scopes practice report was to think of ways that at a system level we could enable those, and to get through the barriers of payment, of regulation, and you know, some of the other professional structures that seem to anchor us into the siloed practice that we know aren't optimal.
Siobhan, just to finish, I'd like to ask you a couple of quick questions. If you were going to recommend a place to do reading or some resources, what would you recommend to nurses?
You know, B&J and Lancet are good because they don't just publish medical articles. But I would not just look for nursing articles. I would be looking at what they've published in oncology or in cardiac. In your particular area, you can subscribe to notifications. It's not a big deal, and you can just look down the abstracts. And if you have access to a library, which people in the academic centres have, I'm not sure that everybody has. But the thing about a journal like British Medical Journal is they don't publish super specialised papers in a subspecialty area. So it's not some, it's assumed it's for a broader audience, and it's usually got to be of importance in the field or in the area. And I think keeping very current with these sorts of ideas is actually just a really good thing to do. I think that nursing academic journals or subspecialty journals are largely only, you would only have time for if you were doing research in a particular area. They're not targeted for a general interest type reading. The other thing to do is to look at health reports on The Guardian, BBC, New York Times, Globe and Mail. They have health pages. And just looking at those, I think, gives you a sense of what are some of the trends, discussions, scandals, controversies. You know, these things are good just to know what's in that zeitgeist, what's in that, what people are talking about in healthcare. Mm-hmm. Because people working, if they're not involved in further education, can feel very remote to all of that, and that's just a good way of reading the latest article on diurnal rhythms and sleep deprivation. You know, you can apply it to yourself, you can apply it to your family, you can apply it to your patients. You know, like they're good things to do. Noise reduction, you know, these are all health topics, and they're not for people doing education or for people doing research, but they're good reading. There's also health writers, if people find one that they like, that are, you know, pretty widely published in the Washington Post and various other sorts of things. So you find a name of someone whose stuff you think is interesting, and you can just follow them on Twitter or on Instagram and see what's going on. That's also a good thing to do.
Well, thank you so much, Siobhan.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
This episode was created with financial support from Sinai Health System and the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario's Advanced Clinical Fellowship Program. All opinions expressed here are entirely my own. Thank you, as always, to the incredible staff of 14 North. For resources, links to Siobhan's work, and more episodes, please visit atthebedside.ca. You can subscribe on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Find At The Bedside on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. Remember, if you didn't document, you didn't do it. Ratings, reviews all help get these perspectives recognized and promoted within the algorithms. We're in healthcare. It's what we do all day. Log in there and click those buttons.